Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
He started playing in a little Brisbane band called Bay City Union. Then came the Masters Apprentices. They were called the Rolling Stones of Australia. His experiences in those bands led him to hang up the bass guitar and take on the role he is best known for today as being the manager of the Stars. Little River Band, Delta Goodrum, and of course John Farnham have all had his managerial touch. Glenn Wheatley has had many, many successes, and in recent times he's had some failure too. After being convicted for tax fraud, Wheatley spent some time in jail. An experience, he says, has changed his values dramatically. Excuse me. There is much to talk to Glenn Wheatley about, and so I'm so glad he's given us his time tonight. Please welcome Glenn Wheatley.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
As we've been talking about you, Glenn, amongst ourselves in the office over the last week or so, just preparing for our chat tonight, nice things, Glenn, nice things.
Okay, I can relax. Okay.
You can relax. We've been thinking, you know, there's two broad strands, really, to your professional life. One has been the music strand, and the other one has been the entrepreneurial strand, both of which have been, you know, kind of there in equal measure.
Well, I guess music is the base for me. I mean, it always has been. I left school at a very young age to enter the music industry. I joined a professional band, as you know, and I went on and had an enormous run of success with a group called the Masters Apprentices. And I guess from that point, I've stayed in gainfully employed in the music business all my life. But it's not an easy business to survive in, and I think that you do learn to become an entrepreneur as well, because there's no safe route in the music business. At the bottom end, it can be quite depressing, because you're living just below the poverty line. There's no doubt about that. Mm. At the top end, the rewards are fantastic, and that's what keeps you going, and that's always the incentive, and that's always why you just keep rolling that dice just one more time. You just keep going for it, because the rewards, as I said, can be fantastic, and it is very rewarding.
What kind of family were you born into, Glenn? You know, what kind of environment gave you these kinds of gifts and abilities?
I came from a very working-class background. My father, his greatest achievement in life was that he survived Tobruk in World War II. It was, I can't imagine what he went through as a 23-year-old, 24-year-old in Tobruk. And his greatest achievement in life was surviving that. He left this country with a famous photograph of him with five mates, all arm in arm with their kit bags over their shoulders, boarding the Queen Mary. Sadly, my father was the only one that came back. Mm. And so he thought himself a very fortunate and lucky man. But he was a hard worker. He was a truck driver, and I've only known him to be a labourer all his life. And I was born up in it would be the lower class. I mean, we struggled as a family, and I had to get out at a very early age. My folks couldn't afford to keep me at school. I had to get a job, and it was the greatest pleasure of my life at the age of 15 to be able to come home and give them my first board check, you know, or board cash, I should say. There was no checks in those days.
What was your job? What were you doing at the age of 15?
A job that doesn't exist anymore. It was called photolithography, and basically that's been taken over now with computers. It was the reproduction of photographs for newspapers and colour magazines, and as I said, a job that really doesn't exist because it's all done on computer now.
Yeah. So did you ever go to do any higher education after that?
No.
See, this is interesting, isn't it? You know, so many entrepreneurs actually have left at, say, year 10 or something, and they've
It was year 10. I never got to year 11 or year 12, and I've only ever learnt by being on the street and teaching myself a lot of the times, even the music business. I mean, when the Masters Apprentices broke up in London, I took a job with a management company, and I set about learning the business side of music. I got every contract I could get my hand on, publishing, recording, management, and I read them until I knew them. I read them until I understood them. I studied them. I just made it my life to get into the business side of music.
But it actually started before then, didn't it? Because even while you were with the Masters Apprentices, you had already started to kind of take on the managerial roles, and you already started to dabble in that for other bands as well, weren't you?
It was. I mean, I had some great lessons when I was playing with the band, and the most vivid of all lessons that I learnt was one night in Brisbane, my hometown, and we'd been brought home to headline Festival Hall. There must have been 5,000 screaming kids there that were going crazy. I mean, they stormed the stage. It was like the storming of the Bastille. I mean, all my clothes were ripped off me. I was down to one sock and you know, a pair of jockettes. And I had my guitar around me, and I looked for all the world like I was naked. And in fact, the police came on and said, "You're obscenely dressed now. You're going to have to shut the show down." Well, the crowd went even more berserk. I mean, we only did five songs before we had to get out. And we escaped that night in the back of an ambulance with the siren going just to get us out of the venue. And I got back to the hotel that night, and I'm sitting down going, I can't believe that what had just happened to me. I mean, I was the star there for a section with all the lights on me. The audiences are going nuts. And here I am in the hotel room with nothing but the echo of the promoter going around in my head. He rushed backstage after that show and said, "We had a bigger crowd than the Beatles." Yeah. And I went, hang on. Oh, a bigger crowd than the Beatles. And I started to put two and two together. The Masters Apprentice were headlining that show. We were getting paid $200. And I thought, hang on, 5,000 by, even if it was $4. I mean, the numbers, the maths didn't work out. Uh-huh. And it was that day that the penny dropped for me. I just looked at our manager and I said, what sort of a deal was $200? We drew 5,000 people. So I started to figure out what is the art of knowing, we call it in the business now, the door deal, mm-hmm. where we get paid commensurate to our drawing capacity. Mm-hmm. And that night was a major night for me. I sat down and said, well, first of all, the manager's got to go. I'll take over the management and I'll start to do these sort of deals because we should be paid commensurate to our drawing power. Mm-hmm. If we don't draw, we shouldn't get paid. If we do fill the place, we should get commensurate. So therein
led the career progression.
That was the beginning of my little management start of life, yes.
Glenn Wheatley is with us on Open House right across the nation for our final show for 2009. So here you are, you've moved into management, and then you start to, you know, put your touch on so many bands. You broke Little River Band into the US in the 70s. You know, you launched Delta Goodrum. Of course, the long-term relationship that you've had with John Farnham, which we'll talk about soon. I so want to know from you, Glenn, what is a good musical talent that kind of captures your imagination and says, I reckon these guys might actually have it?
It's a combination of a couple of things. First of all, it's talent. They've got to be able to sing and hopefully sing in tune.
That's a good start, isn't it?
There's a lot of people don't sing in tune, believe me. And to somebody like myself, that starts to become... It's like scratching your fingers down a blackboard. You know, you get this weird feeling in your head, between your ears, that something's not right here. But there's also... There's a charisma factor, and more importantly, there's a desire. These people have got to want to get there because there's going to be some hard times in front of them, and if they think it's all going to be easy, they're going to be wildly disappointed and they're just not going to make the cut. Mm-hmm. And I think it's those people with real determination that you can pick up on. And I mean, I have to say, I mean, Delta Goodrum, although I had a falling out with her mother, who basically took over the management at some point, why I got enthused about Delta was precisely her enthusiasm to make it. She was a young girl. She was 14 years of age. I mean, too young, really, to be managed, but I still couldn't help myself because of her approach to me personally. I mean, she was smart. She knew that I was a mad Sydney Swan supporter, and she wrapped up her CD in red and white.
This
14-year-old is thinking of, because that got my attention. I mean, out of all the CDs that come in every day of my life, that one got my attention, and I played it, and I thought, it's not bad.
It's not bad.
You know, she's got a way to go. She's only 14, and it took me the better part of 3 years before we got to number one, and we got her there. But, I mean, that's because she needed to mature, but there was always something there.
And what process did you work through? Let's use Delta as an example. What process did you go through over those 3 years to get her ready?
Well, I had to convince her, first of all, that, look, it's not going to happen overnight. And she kept on, and her mother particularly, sorry, Mrs. Goodrum, but she was, you know, Britney's doing this and, you know, Beyonce's doing this and why isn't my daughter doing this? I said, because your daughter is not ready. She is not ready yet. Mm-hmm. She's 14. Mm-hmm. She's going to, you know, let's wait until she's 16. Let's get it. Her voice has got to mature. She's got to mature. She's writing songs about what? She hasn't had a life yet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so she had to mature herself. And I sent it around the world. I sent it up with some of the best songwriters. We sent it to New York, to Los Angeles, to London, Helsinki, Finland. I mean, wherever there were good writers, Sweden produced good writers. And I just put her into writing school, and she had to do this to get to that point where we finally found... You're the voice. wrong artist.
Yeah. Slightly higher voice.
But until we found, Born to Try. I mean, and once I heard that demo, I got goosebumps over me. I knew that we'd finally found the song. Mm-hmm. We'd found it. I mean, mm-hmm. and it was just this rough demo with her sitting on the piano, and... that was it. Mm-hmm. And I had the same thing with John Farnham. I mean, John was exactly the same boat. I mean, I couldn't, after he had his early career as Johnny, and we were mates way back then. We flattered together when we were both 18. To get him back again took an awful amount. I couldn't get him a record deal. I couldn't get anyone interested. But I'd made him a promise that we were going to do an album. And I went and mortgaged the house. I did whatever it took to pay for him, because I couldn't get him a deal, so I had to pay for the first album myself, and thank goodness I did. because by the time that we finally found You're the Voice, again, I knew that we'd had that last ingredient. That was it. That had John's name all over it. Mm. And I knew from there that I was confident that we wouldn't look back.
And still the biggest selling Australian album of all time.
It is, indeed. Whispering Jack is still the biggest selling album of all time, and I'm happy to say that Delta Goodrum is the second biggest album.
There we are. this is Open House, right across the nation. Here we are live from Docklands, and Glenn Wheatley is our special guest. Glenn, we need to touch on this so that we can move on. Operation Wickenby.
Yes.
Australia's largest tax fraud investigation, and you were the first person that was convicted after, I think it ran for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. You were the first person. At the time, I remember you saying that you felt, because of your profile, that led you to be kind of the whipping boy for the investigation. At the same time, you were also quick to say that you had done wrong. That was also a public statement mm-hmm. you made. Mining the lessons out of what happened, what went wrong? What was the decision that got you into that situation?
It was the most traumatic period of my life. This is not a mea culpa. It's not me trying to say, oh, poor pity me, and I was a victim. To a degree, I was targeted. There's no doubt about that. I took some bad advice from my lawyer, advice that I was entitled to receive. I was painstakingly stupid to accept that advice. I was naive in the extreme. I honestly thought that I was paying a tax in Switzerland, that the money was being... it was so easy. I didn't even see the money. He just took it and said, look, you're going to be paying a smaller tax by me taking it offshore. It's not illegal to have an offshore bank account. What is illegal, of course, if you don't pay tax on it. Now... the day that my home house was raided and at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was on tour with John Farnham. I wasn't even at home. That's how together the Crime Commission were. I wasn't even there. Mm-hmm. They were looking for me, of course. All they got was Gaynor and a nightie, and my darling wife and kids that were woken up with guys running around with guns and going... There was 20 of them. And just went through every single drawer, every single file... looking for evidence that I had taken money offshore. Now, it wasn't a lot of money to some people. Yes, it may sound a lot, but I really was a minnow in the scheme of things, because they were chasing millions and millions and millions of dollars, and I was nothing. They're chasing $300 million in alleged tax avoided money. I was a couple hundred thousand dollars, so I always asked, where was the other $299,800,000 that they wanted to claim. Look, it was a long story, but I immediately thought, I've done the wrong thing. I have broken the law. I immediately set about paying back the tax. I immediately set about paying my own designated fine. I knew that I would be penalised for that. I pleaded guilty. I cooperated. I thought I had an arrangement in place where they said, for your continued cooperation, we will not incarcerate you. And I thought, well, thank you. But a month before the trial, the DPP changed their mind and sent me a letter in writing saying, we're going to take me to the full letter of the law. And this, of course, is after I've signed my complete declaration and confession, if you like. And I felt then that it didn't look good. I went into the court thinking, I think I'm going to go to jail. No one thought I would. My lawyer didn't think I would. My wife and family basically said, oh, goodbye, darling, in the morning. She said, I'll see you at lunch when you're home. I didn't come home for 15 months. Mm-hmm. I didn't come home. Mm-hmm. And it was a complete shock to me, mm-hmm. and a worse shock to my family. And
a shock to everybody else who's watching in. Kind of like, Glenn Wheatley is on his way to jail?
Well, look, I did try to do the right thing, but I can't escape the fact that I performed a criminal offence.
So what would you do differently now?
There's no way. If my lawyer had told me what I was doing would be a criminal offence, I would never have done it. I was never told. I was never given that sort of advice. I thought I was just fudging my income tax return. I thought, you know, doesn't everybody? Sorry. I thought to myself.
At least you're
honest. Naively. But, I mean, you know, you try to pay as less tax as you can. And that's honestly what I thought I was doing. I know it sounds incredibly naive, but honestly, it was one of those situations that I should have known better. Mm-hmm. The judge thought I should have known better. He was merciless on me, and I was shocked. I mean, I just couldn't believe my ears when he said, you're going to jail for 15 months. Yeah. And with that last sentence, when he just said, take the prisoner away, I was trembling. I mean, mm-hmm. take the prisoner away. What had happened to my life? I mean, all of a sudden, I'd gone through such a terrific life. I had such great success. Yes, I'd had ups and downs. I'd lost money. I'd made money. I mean, I'm a punter. I'm an entrepreneur, not a punter. I don't punt, but I'm an entrepreneur. And you don't win them all the time. But I'd always managed to keep on my feet. But this was the worst level of my life, and to go to jail is not something that I can recommend to anybody.
I bet not. So you had 10 months in jail, 5 months following that on home detention.
Yep.
So, I mean, you had 10 months to think a lot and to reflect a lot. A lot of people start thinking about ethical issues, religious issues, spiritual issues. Did your mind go there at all?
Yes, it did. And, in fact, the prison chaplain was a lovely man to me, and I must say the Salvos also helped me a lot. I've done a lot for the Salvos over the years. I've done a lot of charity work for them, a little thing called the Spirit of Christmas CD that we put together for the last 13 years and raised mm-hmm. a lot of money for the Salvos every Christmas, and they were wonderful to me. But I did need help. Because, yes, you get in there and you've got time on your hands, and I'm claustrophobic at the best of times all my life, and to be behind bars is something that I can't begin to tell you the fear and the terror that goes through you. Your heart is pounding. Mm. And also, inside, you become, with a profile, I have to say, you become a bit of a target. And there's people wanting to have a go at you just for the sake of having a go at you.
Tall poppy.
I didn't offend anybody. I kept my head down. You just don't do too much eye contact because you can get yourself into trouble. Mm. And there's always some guy prepared just to come up and just give you one because they...
Cause who you
just
are.
For bragging rights.
Yeah, right.
And you've got to be careful. And the boys in blue had a bit of a task on their hands to keep me safe. And there were times when they said, we want you, Glenn, to come in and lock your cell from the inside tonight.
Right.
What are you trying to tell me? Hmm. We're telling you to lock it from the inside so that nobody can get into you. So you go to bed and your heart is pounding.
Did you pray?
Well, I have to say that it was with the help of the chaplain on more than one occasion that he had me in tears, not, you know, just because it just comes out. It's just emotion. And you sit down there and he tries to just find something that's good out of what is an incredibly bad situation. And I'm asking myself, why am I here? How did this happen? How did this possibly happen to me, of all people, to be in jail? Now, there's no doubt that I broke the law, so I keep coming back to myself and I scold myself for being so stupid about this thing. But I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't play with anyone else's money. I didn't. It was, you know, the judge would say, well, it's a crime that hurts a lot of people because if you don't pay tax. Well, maybe. I just know that there are many, many companies and many, many organisations that made me look like an absolute minnow compared to what's going on out there. And I, before I went in, had paid every penny of that tax back. I'd paid it. Mm-hmm. And that's what shocked me.
So there's a sense of injustice for this.
A little bit, but I can't say poor pity me because I've still got to be hard on myself for being so stupid. So I sort of, in some way, deserved it.
So guilt and injustice to the two of them together. A certain sense of guilt because you were involved and you had a certain sense of injustice over it as well.
There is that element. But, I mean, I do think that I was made an example of, and they got a scalp, and all of a sudden I'm making front page of every newspaper, and all of a sudden my house is being besieged by photographers day after day after day, and my family had to learn to live with this. These people were sleeping in cars outside the house. I mean, sleeping for weeks on end. We did become... And I just kept on saying to myself, I don't understand why it's got so much publicity.
It's definitely because of the profile, isn't it? It really is because of the profile. I remember just after you finished your 15-month sentence, you told the West Australian, quote, "I'll never be quite the same again. My values have changed dramatically. Now that I'm out, I'll appreciate my life more than ever." How will your life change as a result now?
Well, my values have changed dramatically. I mean, I do appreciate... I've always... had the fortune of having an extraordinarily close family. My children and my darling wife, we are as one. It is an amazing... I am a lucky man for this. And what my family have gone through, and to have them still to this day, I mean, I can't kick my kids out. They won't leave. I mean, they're still... They won't leave.
It's not fair, is it, Glenn?
And you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. I just love it, you know. But and it is... It has helped me enormously. That value has never changed. That has just been re-strengthened and reinforced beyond. But
your wife, Gaynor, as well. I mean, you've got a long-term marriage there too. That's been so solid.
She is my rock. There's no doubt about that. She does so much, and she is part of my business. She is everything. I mean, I am very lucky. I mean, I've paid a terrible price. The price of incarceration. I mean, I've now got a conviction for the rest of my life. I have to bear this, and I pick up the papers whenever Operation Wickenby gets a name check. I seem to get a name check. Wheatley goes hands down with Wickenby. Mm.
And you're labelled now, aren't you?
I have a conviction. So that is going to be something I have to live with for the rest of my life. And I've been punished terribly for the sin that I did, and it is tough. But you know what? I'm through it. I've had my moments since I've been out. I actually went through a worse period when I was out than what I was in when I was in, and I don't know why. Is it the build up? Is it the is that first plane trip where you're going on? Everybody's going ooh. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can see them. You can see them mouthing. You know, in the fingers and the pointing. So you know that you're on show. So you've got to be calm and you've got to be aware all the time that it's on. I have to say though that the response that I've had from the general public has been overwhelmingly supportive. Everywhere I go, I get random guys just crossing the street to come and shake my hand and say, "Good on you, mate." And I'm going, well, thank you. I mean, I don't know this person. And it is extraordinary, the support that I have got out of this thing, and I am overwhelmed by it. But it still has had an effect. Mm-hmm. It did get me to a point where I needed a little bit of help. I needed to go, I've got to take a deep breath here because I was anxious, I was nervous, I couldn't face crowds for a while. And to be honest, this is the first time that I've actually been in this situation talking to people like you, and there's probably 150 people in there, the people who are listening in this room, that, and I've never done this, I've not done this since I've been out.
And we're very grateful that you have.
We really are.
We could talk to you for hours, Glenn, and I don't know, maybe we're going to have to arrange some sort of second meeting, because there's a whole bunch of other questions here about entrepreneurialism and all of the stuff that you've actually done here, because we've touched on a 10% portion of what you've actually done.
We haven't even started.
Would you continue that relationship with those chaplains that you met? You know, I mean, the fact is, we've heard from people tonight like John Graham, who has been at the forefront of helping these communities get over Black Saturday, and he found himself crumbling as a result of just simply being out there helping people. The fact is that the help needs to continue after the big crisis, after the big event. Will you continue to have those conversations? Do you think so?
Yes. No, look, it's almost therapeutic for me to talk about it. I don't mind it. I mean, people are afraid of... I mean, John Farnham on this last tour, I mean, I became... He used to always send up his mother-in-law, you know, call her the dragon every time, and you know, it was all the dragon jokes. Mm. All of a sudden, I became the butt of his jokes on this last tour. And you know what? I didn't mind at all. I mean, because what he was doing was taking the elephant out of the room. I was able to walk into the audience after the show, and there was no one going, we can't talk. You know, John had made fun of it. He'd made light of it, and I don't want to make light of it because I did break the law. I didn't go there. I wasn't entirely exonerated for what I did. I felt I was harshly done by, and I think that I got a manifestly, you know, over the top sentence. But
sure.
John was able to just make it acceptable for the people, and it made me even more acceptable. I was able to go out there, and it was only my worst period of time was just before the start of this tour, because I knew that I'd be walking into venues full of thousands of people, and you know what? I was decidedly uncomfortable. It's not the right word. I was paranoid. I mean, I had a serious problem, and I really had to get over this thing. And I had to sit down with some people, and they had to talk to me, and they had to explain and just walk me through it, and just give me the confidence to come back again. And I can honestly say I am back again. I feel confident. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here tonight. Mm-hmm. But I think I've paid for my penance. I've done the crime, and I've paid for it with the ultimate penalty. Now it's time for me to get back on top again and get back on with my life, and I've got to get my business up and started again. Everything lost momentum, as Gaynor said. You know, we lost the Energizer Bunny there for a long time because I mean, this little thing that's hopping around all the time. I was locked away, and you can't even make. I can only make 10 phone calls a week. I mean, you can't do. You know, your life changes dramatically, now I'm back, and I it's good to be able to get out again and just be my own man. And I appreciate the freedom. Yeah. I appreciate the fact that I can breathe fresh air, and I can go for a walk down to the newsagent to buy the newspaper.
Yeah.
The little things that you think, a wish when you're inside, those little dumb things that you wish you could do, you just can't do.
Well, Glenn, I'm going to be praying for you that from this moment on, you know, those life lessons will continue to congeal. And of course, you know, this is a Christian program. You know I'm going to say this, Glenn. I'm going to pray that, you meet the forgiver. Because, he is life-changing, but...
My little chaplain played for me when I was in jail, and it helped me. And that's all I can say. I mean, it broke me. I couldn't hold back the emotion. I couldn't hold back the tears. But it just gives you something, and you need something like that to hang on to, particularly when you're in somewhere like that. Because without that, if you've got nothing to come to after that, then you're really in a bad way. And I saw a lot of it inside. There were people there that had nothing to come home to. They didn't have a home. Mm. They didn't want to... I knew they're going to be back. They're the sad cases. You knew they're going to be back. that they get dropped off at the bus stop with their possessions in a green garbage bag and enough money to pay for the bus or the train fare back to Melbourne, and that's it.
Yeah.
I did time, but at least I had something to look forward to, and it was a faith, and it was an ability to think that I'm going to be able to do it again. I can get on with my life.
Well, Glenn Wheatley, it's been fascinating to talk to you, and I do appreciate your time. Please thank Glenn Wheatley.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.